Hi, friends. I have a little surprise for you. I got together with Valerie Homaker of Latter-day Struggles, and we took your questions about parenting teens in and around the LDS Church. So I hope you enjoy this fun episode, and I hope you find it helpful.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Latter-day Struggles.
And Ask Dr. Julie Hanks podcast.
We are back together again because we had so much fun last time. Julie and I decided we wanted to get together from time to time and both tackle tough topics and also periodically answer some of your questions. And today, what we're going to do is we are going to be responding to a number of questions that many of you have asked both of us from our social media platforms as it regards the tough topic of parenting adolescents in and around the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so both Julie and I got a lot of questions.
A lot of interest in this topic.
Well, and we thought, well, how many, we could spend a couple of dozen hours on answering these. So we went through them and picked a few themes. And this is not to say if your question is not answered here, that's not saying that it isn't a good question and it's not important. And we are banking these questions because we do want to continue to come on from time to time and address topics of this nature. So hopefully some of the questions that you asked us are going to be addressed, and maybe some questions that you didn't ask are going to be addressed, because there, of course, were some common themes that played out in the several dozen questions that we both received. Anything you want to add before we get started, Julie? And then I'll read the
question. I think this is such a difficult time for parents, especially with adolescents being so bright and so accepting and loving that it's like they're asking questions that never occurred to us, you know? So
Amen.
Here we go. Here we
Amen.
Go.
Yes, they are bright. They're savvy. I know for myself, when I was raising my older two daughters who are now young adults, I did a lot of poor parenting. And I was uncomfortable because I was Orthodox myself. And God bless my daughters, they were not satisfied. And they told me as much. They're like, Mom, you can't just not address these things. These things are important and they matter and you need to deal with them. And of course, I, at that point in time, continued to choose not to deal with them. And that didn't do my relationship with my children any favors. And so, I see all of you out there who are kind of in this struggle, and I guess I've already outed myself a little bit, but as Julie and I are answering these questions, I guess I'm going to just speak for myself here, but I feel like personally I've come a long way, and also I feel pretty insecure about parenting my kids. I just fundamentally think it's a hard thing to do in general.
Mm-hmm.
You take that and multiply it by the complexities of a faith journey, and it's just, it's really hard. I feel pretty vulnerable sometimes. And so hopefully, at least as you're listening to my responses, you can take some of the things that you hear. You may not agree with everything I say, and I may not agree with everything I say when I listen to this after it, because I'm really trying to work this out myself. And so let's just see where we go.
Yeah, it's a process. Definitely. It's just such a process.
Okay, here we go. Question number one. This listener says, I'm an active member, but I don't agree with everything. How do I support my kids in bringing them to church and lessons, but talk to them about the things I don't necessarily agree with? Why don't you go ahead and start us off, Julie?
Yeah, I think you can say just that. The church teaches some things that I don't agree with, and they are this, this, and this. If you hear a teacher talking about this, please come to me and we'll have a discussion. I want you to be able to decide for yourself, not just what I believe, but what you believe. And let's talk about how do you know? How do you know truth? How do you recognize truth? So I think honesty is often the best way to approach kids. Just, you know, I have a sister who says to her children, you don't have to believe anything that's taught at church that's not true.
That's beautiful.
And I love it.
It's profound. And for some people, that feels a little bit edgy because I think sometimes we have been taught to believe anything that is said at church, especially if it's by a priesthood holder or a priesthood leader. And so I want to just say amen and amen. Everything you just said, I 100% agree with, Julie. And also, I want to just throw in my two cents and add a couple things. Just because for me, I noticed for myself the hardest part of moving into the kind of conversation that you just sort of modeled for us, it was really scary and tricky when I was new at it. Meaning that when I was transitioning from the mom that was a passive receiver of church and of belief, and then I started shifting and changing internally myself, and then it occurred to me that, like, oh dear, I need to share with my children my process because I'm going to start parenting them different. And that's going to feel a little weird to them to be like, well, why don't we talk about that? Because I don't really know if I feel that way about that. Like, I do that on the regular now as a mom of adolescents, but I do remember for myself having to kind of actually orient my children around where I was moving in my faith journey. Something that would sound perhaps like this. Hey guys, because I'm going to say guys, because the kids at home are boys right now. And I would say, so dad and I are thinking about a lot of things that relate to the church. We still go. And there are still things in there that we think are valuable. But because dad and I are growing and changing and shifting, we're starting to actually realize that it's super important to acknowledge when things don't feel right. And we've taught you that perhaps we always follow the prophet and always believe because it's been said. And actually, we are realizing that maybe that's not the healthiest way for us to be. So we're going to start having conversations with you guys where we're inviting you to ask your questions and challenge things that don't feel good to you because we're doing that ourselves. And so I guess what I'm trying to say, I'm out of role play now, is that I want to, not only do we talk about these things like content wise, but I actually offer to my son's process words. Like, we're going to change the process of talking about spirituality in this house where questioning now is invited, whereas before.
Encouraged even.
And be explicit about that, because I think sometimes because kids, their brains are developing and they move from black and white thinking to more complex thinking, that I think it's always helpful and productive to just be explicit. Just say, hey, this might sound weird to you because I've never actually pushed back against this, that, and the other. But now in this home, because of our growth, we're going to. And I've noticed with my kids, they're like, cool, because teenagers are already in that mode. They're like, oh, you're just going to be more like me, mom. Like, you know, they like pushing back. So yeah, that's kind of my thoughts on that. Anything else you want to add to that, Julie?
I just only that it's okay to say, if it's awkward for you to say, this is kind of hard for me, or this is a little awkward, or this is really different from how we've done things in the past, and just name it.
I can't tell you how many times I've actually said that to my kids because I feel like having gone through graduate school to become a therapist when my oldest was an early adolescent, times did I say, I used to do that differently and I've learned a different way to be with you. And it's beautiful. I think in some ways it's modeling that, like, yeah, I might be your mom. And also I make a lot of mistakes and I'm okay with that. Like, I am a work in process and I'm growing. And I think that helps the children see that it's okay that they're also works in process and they're growing too. One other thing that what you just said, Julie, brings to my mind something that I think is important in the spirit of addressing this question. And this is something that I feel like is a big deal to talk about because they're going to go back to church and hear the opposite kind of rhetoric, which is we don't question everything and we don't, you know, so they're going to be actually hearing a different way of being in relationship with God, with truth, with the church at church. And so once again, in the same vein, I think it's so important for us as parents to just say, hey, listen, in our home, this is what we're doing because we feel like it's healthy and important. And at churches in general, our church included, but churches are organizations that do struggle a little bit with being black and white thinkers. That's part of what churches sort of excel in a little bit. It's almost like normalize that that's what churches do because they like to believe they're right. And I also personally feel like it's helpful to not make this like a Mormon problem, but to make it a problem around organized religion, that this is a tendency of what churches tend to want to do. And so if you hear those black and white, all in, all out statements, boys, just know that that's where they are and that's what helps them stay comfortable. So they don't have to feel like they need to get adversarial in certain church settings. There may be a time and a place to speak up, but for them to actually recognize that the lay of the land is such that at church, they're going to be feeling uncomfortable, but they can just recognize that's like, oh, that's normal for, that's what these people do because for them, that feels okay for them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's great. So, love it.
Okay. Let's move to question number two. All but my 16-year-old son have left the church. How can I support him the best?
I guess implied in that is in continuing to go when no one else is going to church.
That's the sense I got, that he wants to be active and this parent wants to know how to be supportive to this young man who's still choosing to be active in the church.
Yeah. I don't know. This one doesn't seem that hard to me. It's just like, well, encourage him to make his decisions and encourage him to go and ask questions and be interested, just like you would if he were in a, you know, in choir and you weren't musical, or, you know, just be interested just like you would in any other area of his life.
Yeah. I like that. I'm thinking about, even though it's not stated in this question, I wonder if what she or he is implying here is that maybe there's some discomfort around the fact that some of the family members have left and maybe this child is feeling insecure or feeling not supported or feeling different than the rest of the family that has left. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's true, but let's just pretend for a moment.
Yeah, it makes sense for sure. Right.
So let's just say that perhaps some thoughts I would give if that were the reality is to explicitly speak to the adolescent son that I, as their mother, as his mother, I am grateful for what he is thinking and feeling and believing, and I honor and respect it, even if brothers and sisters are on a different path, or even if I feel differently. And I think once again, Julie, you and I, you're going to already probably have noticed, this is about teaching our adolescents to be increasing in their capacities to be differentiated human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And the church doesn't necessarily explicitly teach that, nor do they oftentimes reinforce it. And so what we're trying to do is say, hey, even in this home, we unconditionally love you just as you are and as you believe. And if this feels like it really works for you, I, as your mom, want to respect that. And you don't have to believe the same way as I do. I don't have to believe the same way as you do. I'm happy to answer your questions or offer you my perspective. But I want you to be sort of forging your own path, and I'm going to be your support system in this, even if it feels different. So,
yeah. I would also talk to the other siblings, if there are other siblings in the house, to say, look, this is where, you know, this child is, and I'm supportive of that. And it's not okay for you to put that down, make fun of, mock, anything like that. We don't do that in our house.
I really love that you added that, Julie, because I do think it's important for us to be at like equal opportunity advocates of our growing up children's realities and how they view the world, and to recognize that like black and white thinking on either side of the spectrum is not helpful. So for the kiddo that I say kiddo, although he's 16. So we'll say for the young man who is wanting to stay, it's no more appropriate for him to be judging and shaming his siblings who no longer want to participate than it's just as inappropriate for the kids who have left to be judging and shaming the child who wants to stay. So to offer this place that like in this home, this is not about what we believe and what we observe. It is that we as a family love and support one another on our unfolding journeys, period. Mm-hmm. Like we are not going to, and we can ask questions, we can have dialogue, but we want to keep this space safe so that, and what we're really doing is we're just trying to model for our children what a healthy community looks like, because that's what we wish would happen more frequently elsewhere, right? So we want it to happen at home. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's great.
Let's hit question number three. How can I parent around black and white thinking that happens at church? The absoluteness, the we are the only true church ideas specifically.
I think that's an example of saying that's not how I see things. I think there's value and truth everywhere. And it's okay to acknowledge that. And it's okay to acknowledge there's truth here.
Yeah.
But I would explain hierarchy. And whenever you create a hierarchy of we're better than, or someone else is better than you, that's not love. That's competition, comparisons. And to say the only this or the better or the true is creating a hierarchy, which that just doesn't strike me as how heavenly parents work.
What you just said, I love, Julie, because you're embodying your parenting in the concept of like what we do here is it's grounded in love. And I think perhaps through each of these challenging conversations that we have with our children, we can kind of let that be the foundation of everything. And then from that foundation, we can help our children learn how to become discerners of them for themselves. But I do think what a lot of these parents are asking us is, how do I have these hard conversations with kids that by default are introducing different ideas than what they learned at church?
Mm-hmm.
And I know for myself, I was a little bit concerned, especially early on in my own process, that perhaps I would be confusing my kids. That, oh my goodness, they're going to be so confused. They're hearing this at church and they're hearing this at home. And then I kind of thought to myself, well, isn't that what evolving and growing brains are actually equipped to be able to manage? Like mm-hmm. differing ideas coming from different sources and just giving them the capacity to know how to think, if not what to think. Like, I don't want to teach my kids what they're supposed to think or what they're supposed to believe. I want to help them right. learn how to be thinkers. Mm-hmm. And what you just did there, I thought was really beautiful because you actually created a little bit of a framework, which is like hierarchies in any way, shape, or form hurt people. If we have to be better than, that means someone has to be worse than us and we're making them less than. And in the eyes of God, no one is less than. And so then we can integrate that into the way the church sort of self-defines. And to that, I might even actually add that sometimes people and churches, because they are governed by fear, because many of us are, we like to create these hierarchies to keep us safe. And if we're like the very best, most beloved church in like the whole wide universe, then God loves us the best and we're the safest. And so it's almost like we're giving the church grace that in the service of managing anxiety, we create these things. But as a mom to a child, we can be like, yeah, but that hurts people. So we don't have to buy into that rhetoric, even though it's a common thing that people in churches do to create bubbles of safety in a mm-hmm. world that is uncertain. And of course, I would have said that probably in a little more simple terms, but
yeah,
creating structure around, you're going to hear this at church. And this is like a graceful, compassionate way to explain some of the things that the church teaches that is not correct. And this is why they do it. They're managing anxiety. They're afraid. Mm-hmm. And it's not the way we believe it. And this is why. Mm-hmm. And so we're teaching our children how to be complex thinkers by being complex thinkers in their presence and walking them through reasons why we have shifted our own beliefs away from the more black and white thinking and helping them have the permission to do the same thing.
Amen.
So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
That's great.
All right. Let's move to question number 4. Okay. This is a good one. How do I teach my kids about garments and the temple when I don't really feel good about wearing them myself?
Do you want to go first? I've kind of been jumping in.
Yeah, sure. I can start with this one. So I've actually given this quite a bit of thought. I think that perhaps the very best way to teach, let me go broad and then I'll zoom in on garments and temple. I personally have found in my own faith journey that I have benefited a lot by learning about spirituality and spiritual systems and religion in the big picture, Eastern religion, Western religion, the history of churches and religions. And I was really intrigued by, and I actually felt really, I guess, comforted by the reality that most religious systems have a system of sacred clothing, whether it be a Catholic priest that wears a certain kind of robe or people of the Jewish faith, there are certain ways that they dress for special holidays and things like that. And that this idea in and of itself is somewhat archetypal, meaning it transcends time and space and community and tribe. And so there's something that religious people do in the way that they distinguish themselves through dress that helps them sort of feel connected to God. And so that for me is important, and it might be an important way to talk to our children about this to help them better understand that religious systems tend to move in this direction for their own reasons. And I would also make sure I added that these things are neutral, meaning that they can be used for good and they can be used for evil. And for some people, in any religious system, the wearing of whatever their special clothing is a deep sign of worship, and it resonates with them. And for some people, it doesn't. And that you and me, as human beings in this particular religious system, we get to discern for ourselves if the way we are in relationship with that particular part of our faith truly embodies a deepening relationship with the divine. And then we move into the way that we relate to that in a congruent way so that we feel like it's actually helping us be more like God. Okay, I feel like that was quite a mouthful. Do you want to follow up to that while I gather my thoughts and we can kind of carry on? What are your thoughts on that, Julie?
No, I'm just listening going, yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah, I think giving that larger context, it allows for respect. Like this is not just this weird or different thing we do. It's everybody or many religious traditions have clothing. They have different rituals. And I love that you talked about the point is to become closer to God or to whatever higher power the religion is moving you toward. And that's the goal. And then bringing it to the garment, that's the goal.
Yes.
And if it doesn't do that for you, take that to God and work that out.
Yes. So just to kind of carry on and deepen this point a little bit, I think, well, let's just make, again, when it's just a one or two sentence question, we have to sort of fill in some details and make some things up a little bit. But I'm going to go ahead and make the assumption, because this questioner said, I don't feel good about the temple garment personally, but how do I talk to my kid about this? So, okay. So we already kind of addressed perhaps an idea about how to talk to the child about this. Now, for the woman who is sort of making sense of this because she doesn't personally wear the garment, for her, what is implied there is that she, for her own incredibly legitimate and valid reasons, has found that for herself, due to her background, her experiences, whatever, the garment for her does not feel as if it is a true form of worship that brings her closer to God. And if that is the case, I feel that that ought to be honored. In other words, I personally feel that any form of worship, unless it is something that feels like it really brings us closer to God, like it's not worship if it doesn't bring us closer to God. It's the worship of idols. It's idolatry. And so as we choose how we stay in connection with anything that has to do with our tradition of faith, we want to check in with ourselves. We want to recognize, am I guided by love towards this thing, which makes it worship, or am I guided by something else? Whether it be obligation, guilt, shame, fear, anxiety. And if we're guided by anything other than love, I think it's okay to take a look at it and really make sense of and have a lot of self-compassion on what is the guiding, directing force for that. Because my feeling is that a father and mother in heaven, they want us to be doing things in connection to worship that actually, in fact, lead us closer to God. And so I think that's perhaps why we want to keep this a neutral topic for a teenager, because we don't want to impose on them what the garment means to us, because we want them to come into their own relationship with this particular part of their evolving and expanding spirituality.
I think it's also appropriate to share, this is what the church teaches about the garment.
Yeah.
This is what ideally what it symbolizes. This is what it represents.
Yes.
It may or may not represent those things to me, but this is kind of what our faith tradition says. And then you get to decide how you're going to relate with that specific part.
Yeah, I love that. And I want to add that I read just this morning that really kind of just gave me a lot of pause, which is, well, it gave me pause because I believe personally in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, we are such a literal, you know, toddler religion that was born in, you know, not very long ago relative to other faith traditions, right? And so we don't tend to do well with anything that has to do with anything that's metaphorical or symbolic or abstract. And as soon as that we take anything that is intended to be symbolic and we demand it means something, that is sort of the beginning of a potentially traumatic relationship with that thing. And therefore, I think that a relationship with the garment, I think that's perhaps why it's so fraught in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, because again, taking it big picture to big religion and not just Christianity, whatever clothing that religious systems choose that is sacred is always going to be symbolic in nature. And therefore, clothing that is symbolic in nature needs to be given to the person so that they can make meaning of it themselves. And as soon as somebody starts telling you what something has to mean, and I mean it about garments or anything else, that's sort of the beginning of when someone isn't able to actually grow spiritually as I think God would have us to grow. And so I think it's good for you, though. I mean, to say that I agree with you, though, that it's good for us to, as parents, say, this is the intended significance, or this is the sort of the church correlated significance of this thing. And it's also a symbol of something else. And I think I have a feeling, I'm just trying to like channel what a parent may be thinking as they're listening to us. And I can only imagine some parents who have complex relationships with the temple and the garment being like, hey, but don't you think it's only like responsible for me to tell my kids all of the reasons why I struggle? Right? How would you respond to that, Julie? I'm going to put you on the spot for a second.
I would say, no, that's not your child's business. And that sometimes sharing too much of your own personal struggles can be a burden for your child. Yeah. And so you don't want to burden your child. It depends on the age, their developmental level, the relationship, so many different things. But it's not our job to make sure our child understands us. It's our job to understand our child.
That's really beautiful. I love that. It actually brings to mind a couple that I've worked with as a therapist, where both of them in this progressive LDS faith expansion space, and for one of the partnership, they had a very fraught relationship with the garment, purity culture, shaming, all of the things that you may imagine. And the other partner had nothing but like, I think about the atonement when I wear the garment, and I'm comfortable with it. And it's something that really I don't have a problem with. And I was so grateful that each of them respected their respective relationships with the garment. And one of them very rarely wore them, and the other one wore them all the time. And they respected the realities of each other. Now that is a slightly different here, because this is a partnership of two grown adults that they each knew each other's stories. Now, what you just said, I agree with, Julie, which is to hand an adolescent our fraught, complex relationship with something that is symbolic, I do believe in some ways is, yeah, it's perhaps inappropriate, because we want, again, our child to learn how to look within and to take whatever the LDS theology culture offers and to decide for themselves, does this actually resonate with me? Does it fit with me? And not move from, I have to always follow the prophet, to I have to always follow my mom. Like, I want them to cut the cord from both of those and learn that, guess what? I have been given this beautiful brain, and I can start actually learning for myself what helps me become closer to God, and then move forward and be grateful that my mom and dad respects that and they honor that, which again, actually just strengthens my resolve to be able to do this hard spiritual growth work and recognize that, like, gosh, the people around me trust me. Maybe I can actually do this.
Yeah. How would that be if every adolescent felt like their parents trusted them to figure out their own path?
Yeah.
We'd have a different planet, I think.
I know. It's really true. And yet I think hopefully what you and I are doing, Julie, is we're helping parents become those exact men and women that are instilling a lot of personal authority and agency, like true agency, into our children, because I believe that that truly is what the gospel of Jesus Christ has the capacity to help us do and become.
I agree. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to the next one. Okay. Question number 5. How do I show a Christ-like approach when defending my parental rights while church leaders are trying to overstep?
Ooh, I wish we had more info on this one.
Yeah.
Defending my parental rights while church leaders overstep. Okay, so an example, I'll just come up with an example because I think that is helpful. Calling your child or texting your child to come in an interview without consulting the parent or without parent's permission, like from a bishop or priesthood leader. I think that's inappropriate. And I think it's okay as a parent to set a boundary and say, Bishop, you do not have my permission to meet with my child without my consent and without my presence, or whatever your particular boundary is.
Yeah. Yeah, I think what this is going to require in some ways, as again, we are evolving and growing and pushing up against some of the sort of culture in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that boundaries are bad and wrong. Mm-hmm. like the sort of we never say no to a calling kind of mentality, where we recognize that we're going to enter into some pretty uncomfortable conversations with people and just know that that's the truth. We're going to enter into these conversations that are not going to feel like they go well, mainly because I think we don't tend to have very honed in negotiation skills in the church where we have tough conversations, because oftentimes when anything starts to look like a tough conversation at church, we shut it down because the Holy Ghost has, you know, exited
left the building.
That's right. Just like Elvis.
Yep.
So therefore, what I guess I'm getting at is when we advocate for our children, it means that we are pushing up against the majority culture, which doesn't speak up and doesn't have boundaries. And therefore, what I guess that just means is responding to a bishop, responding to a youth leader, and just saying, let me preface what I'm about ready to say with this, explicitly saying, I think it never hurts to explicitly acknowledge good intent. I think church leaders, by and large, they're doing their best and trying their hardest, and they mean well by our children.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of open up with, thank you for your concern for my child. I really appreciate that. I see you.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to be sending my son to YSA for this, that, and the other reason. And these are our reasons, and this is our family, and I appreciate it, but this is how it's going to be. And so state the gratitude for intent and then state what you feel is your, I think she called it her parental right. Mm-hmm. And then just to kind of also to close that up, I guess to be comfortable or at least manage the discomfort of the invalidation of the leader who are not going to necessarily like or appreciate or validate the stance that we take.
Yeah.
And just learn to live with that as best as we can, because it's going to be uncomfortable and they're probably going to be deeply concerned for the spiritual welfare of our children and our families because we're making boundaries that are uncomfortable to them from where they are. And just it is what it is. So
Tolerate discomfort is a huge, really important skill for grownups to practice. And we don't get a lot of practice in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for having hard conversations.
Right.
Yeah.
I want to add to here something that just sort of came up in my mind is that if we feel like our adolescents are getting pressured to participate in something or to conform in some way that they're not comfortable with, and they bring that up with us as their parents, two things come to mind. Number one is I think it would be great for us to lead out with giving our children opportunities, like helping them with words and how can you address this and how can you talk about this with your leader so that they once again can be learning a skill set of respectful conflict negotiation skills or speaking up for themselves. And then also acknowledging that in certain situations and with certain of our kids, for their own varying reasons, sometimes we may need to participate in and say, as their parents, this is the way it's going to be, and this is how we feel. And I guess to discern from, you know, it's going to be different in different situations, but to participate as needed, but also to help the kids recognize that, again, we don't necessarily get a skill set around self-defining in healthy ways in the church all of the time. And so to help our kids recognize that you may not see this modeled, and none of your friends may be doing this, and they may be all going to girls' camp and none of them maybe want to, but they don't have the voice and their parents won't let them or whatever. But it's okay for you to say that you don't want to do this, that, and the other. And mm-hmm. the reason why I think that's so important is because if we numb out an entire generation of kids or of ourselves and just always do things that we don't want to do, pretty soon we lose a sensitivity to what even we do want to do. And we find ourselves sort of robotically participating in spirituality, and spirituality dies. Whereas if we can say no, then we say no. And then when we say yes, we actually might enjoy it and find it satisfying.
Yeah. And so many adults that I've worked with in my therapy practice can't even articulate what they want because they've been defined by external sources for their whole life. And so asking your adolescent, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
What kind of life do you want to create? And getting them thinking that way in terms of defining themselves and what they want to create with their life.
I'm just laughing because the thought comes to my mind, what a radical idea.
It's like, that we have to even say this, right?
Well, and it sort of has me thinking a little bit back about our To the Mothers of Zion podcast episode that we did, which was, I don't know what I would have done if somebody had said, Valerie, what do you want to become? The sky's the limit. Do whatever and be whatever.
Yeah.
What would that look like? I mean, I don't have any memory of any setting in my adolescence where a grown-up asked me that, right? And so for us to be giving this to our children, and
it's a huge gift.
And the thing that I think people don't tend to understand, that I certainly didn't understand with my older children, is that the more I demand certain ways of being compliant spiritually, the more I'm killing their capacity to actually become authentically spiritual people.
Mm. Right.
That's a high price that we pay to make
for conformity.
Yes. Right. So if we demand that they become spiritual on our terms or on the terms that the church has set forth, what they end up linking with spirituality is rebellion, is boredom, is resistance. And then they recognize, or they come to realize, I don't like church. I don't like God. Mm-hmm. I don't like those things, because we haven't just said, what can this look like in a way that helps you actually feel like you're coming closer to God? And how can this look on your own terms? And then they actually, we're giving them the space to expand and become who they're here to become as spiritual beings. Whereas otherwise, I think we're completely squelching that process and shutting it down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it's easy to do that, right? If our family's salvation depends on everyone complying.
Yep.
It's easy to get caught up in that. Like, you need to do X, Y, and Z in order to be okay.
Well, and I think it's easy to get kids that are compliant and love mom and dad and therefore want to please mom and dad to just do what they're told, even if they don't feel it and they're not connecting it with anything that's actually bringing up their own spiritual formation experiences. Because it's like, well, the alternative is my not being able to be with mom and dad in heaven, although they're not connecting the behaviors that they're participating in with anything that's actually growing their souls.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we might find highly compliant, and that's not everyone. There's going to be some kids that resist, but there also probably are some kids that do comply just because the nature of the way we talk about God and the plan of salvation, it's almost too scary to be free thinking individuals as a child or as an adolescent. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't afford to resist this, because if I believe in what I'm being told about, you know, the plan of salvation, I can't be with mom and dad. And actually, in some ways, I find that really damaging, because the one thing we can do to frighten someone, I mean, the most painful, frightening thing we can ever say to anybody is, you are isolated from the people you love. We can probably get people to comply to almost anything if we lead them to believe that that's actually true.
Well, isolation is the universal form of torture.
Yep.
It's the worst thing you can do to a human being, is threaten or actually isolate them.
And so to invoke in our theology, you must fill in the blank, or you will be isolated from the people that you love the most, who are your parents, especially for a minor, is inappropriate, and it's actually spiritually damaging.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
That was really sad. Take a deep breath.
Yeah, that's so sad. Okay, let's move on to the next question. Actually, this is kind of connected to what we already started talking about. Next question is this. Is it wrong to make seminary and or church attendance an expectation in our home?
I don't think that's wrong. I think parents get to decide what the expectations are in the family. Mm-hmm. And it's their house. Now, what's the impact of that on the child and on your relationship? That's, you want to take that into account. Right. And not just, is the child happy with me, but like, what is the developmental impact of making that boundary? But I don't think it's wrong.
Yeah. I think about being really, really curious as a parent if a child doesn't want to go. And honestly, I think this is a tough question, because I personally think that the answers may be a little different between seminary and church. So I'm going to just stay with, personally, I'm going to just stay with church, because I feel like it'll keep my thought process clear. Mm-hmm. I would really want to know why my child struggles at church, because it could be anything varying from I'm being bullied to I am a queer child and I feel very, very like deep shame, to I, you know, like to stay up too late at night playing video games and I'm just tired, but I don't really have any, you know, problem with church proper. I just don't want to go because I don't feel like it on a Sunday morning at 9. And so I guess for me, I would complicate this, my answer, by hoping that the parent and the adolescent have a strong enough bond and a relationship to where mom or dad could sit down with the kid and say, help me understand what's going on that makes church uncomfortable for you, that makes it a place that is either painful or boring or whatever the thing is. And then I would want to dialogue with them so that I could truly understand what's going on. And then I think I would make the decision based on that, rather than having a like, we always, or like, I personally don't know that I would stand by a, this is the family rule, therefore, with no exception, this is what we do in the Hammacher home, for example. I think it's case by case, and it's dependent on the child and the relationship. Because once again, this sort of circles us back to the last conversation we had with the last question. If I were to do that, and I'm imposing on my child ongoing low to high grade harm, even though where my heart is that I want my child to become closer to God through their relationship with Sunday morning at 9 o'clock at church, I might actually be doing the exact opposite. I might be sabotaging my child's capacity to feel close to God. And so what we have to, I think, look at is the long game and recognize that, like, for me, I care about you as my child. I care about your spiritual growth and development. And I'm more interested in helping you thrive as a child, growing into who you're here to become, which is a sacred and holy thing. And how does your resistance to church play into that? Does it contribute to it, or does it take away from that? Because I want my child to have a sacred, holy experience in their life. And if I'm doing something that is getting in the way of that, then I want to be aware of that so that I don't hurt my child when I think I'm trying to help them.
Yeah, your response has a lot more nuance than I was kind of going with. the kid who's just like, I just don't want to go. I just don't feel like going. You know what I mean?
Yours but, like the video game kid, the video game kid.
Right, right. Or just like, I'm too tired or I don't like it. Or
yeah.
But I totally agree with everything you've said. And I think if with everything you've talked about considering, if you decide, you know, this is what our family does. Like we go to church together or we have Sunday dinner or we have, it's not bad to require things of your kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you have to look at what's the goal? What are you trying to accomplish? If it's family unity, is that going to get you that or will it make, you know, will it push your child away? So I think it's okay to require things and you have to look at why they don't want to do it and why you want them to do it and what's the impact going to be.
Yeah, that's a really good point because I think too, sometimes parents, again, are managing their own anxiety around their children's behavior and how they show up. Especially, I think in our culture, sometimes we have over-identified our value and worthiness based on what my children look like at church, you know, and if they show up and why is he passing the sacrament and, you know, Tiva's in a sweatshirt kind of ideas, right? Like we're managing our own anxiety around what we as a mother or father, how we're being perceived and then to
perception.
Kind of, yes. Mm-hmm. And so to just notice that that may be playing into it too. So
yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to the next question. Let's see here. What to teach teenagers? Oh, this is a good one. What to teach teenagers in a mixed faith marriage when my partner and I don't agree on things? We're both just staring at each other.
Yeah, this is a common one, right?
Yeah.
I think this is such a beautiful opportunity to model differentiation of self. Mm-hmm. Like we can be different and still be close. Mom thinks this, dad thinks this. What do you think?
Yeah. Yes, I love that. And the way I would respond to that too is that I would heavily encourage the partners to do everything that they can to become healthy themselves in their marriage relationship around faith. Because in order to help a child differentiate and do the work that you're recommending, it's going to be infinitely harder if the child feels like they're caught in the crosshairs of parents' faith crisis conflict.
Well, I'm talking about the parents modeling differentiation. Right, which is exactly what you're saying. It's like you have to do your own work to get to the point where you can tolerate the difference in your marriage and model that for your child.
Yes. Yes. Amen. Perfect. Yes. Yes. So it sounds like we were saying the exact same thing. And so as it relates to the child, as long as, and as the relationship, the married relationship or the partnered relationship is doing that work together, meaning that they respect the belief systems of each other. And I would even go so far as to say healthily differentiated married couples in mixed faith marriages sometimes do come to the middle in certain things, meaning that I don't necessarily see this the same way as you do, partner, but I see this as valuable to you. And I can give a little because I may not love it, but I love you. And therefore, I can honor and respect you in this way. And if each partner sees the other both standing on their own two feet in their own faith tradition or belief systems, but also notices a lot of generosity, it's going to be sort of an evolving upward spiral where both partners are trying really hard to both respect and show true love to the other and their differing beliefs, but also they're noticing that the other is letting them be themselves. And I think the most important thing we can do in married relationships with adolescent children is be doing this kind of work so that the child feels like my parents respect each other and I don't have to feel any sort of threat that I'm choosing one over the other, that I can recognize that there's something really beautiful about the way she worships and there's something really beautiful about the way he worships. Or even if someone hasn't got a formal worship practice, I think it's really important, again, to circle back to what we talked about at the very beginning of our time together, to have some very open, explicit conversations with our adolescents, say as a parent maybe transitioning away from formal observance of, in our case, the LDS faith, but they may still clearly be beautiful spiritual people that just don't go to church on Sunday. And we can say, mom or dad is doing things differently, but look at the different ways that they are being beautifully spiritual people, that spiritual people mm-hmm. are not just people that go to church. So that we, again, we're helping our children recognize that all of life is does not reside in the binaries, you know, dad, good, go to church, mom, bad, doesn't go to church, you know, like very, very mm-hmm. overly simplistic thinking. And I think we can model that for our kids, but I think it's also important to say it to our kids that like, we are different. We see things differently, but we love each other. We respect each other in our differing beliefs. And we want you to watch and observe and choose what works best for you.
Yeah. And never, never put down the other parent for their belief system. Because whenever you put down the other parent, it's like the arrow goes through your child's heart before it reaches the other parent. Like any, because they're half the other person. And so just, you know, the kind of side conversations, oh, well, dad doesn't understand, or, you know, yeah. he doesn't think that, or she, that kind of, that's so destructive.
Yeah. Which I think really calls for, again, as the parents in this relationship, in this question, for us to be so self-loving to do our own personal work. Mm-hmm. And become healthy enough ourselves so that we can become differentiated, love the other who is differentiating, and not embroil the child in our struggles with that. And I think it's okay mm-hmm. and probably safe to say in most cases, in situations of this nature, at least in our faith tradition, it's a learning curve. And it's a tough transition for families when one partner evolves and changes. And to just acknowledge that that is inevitable, and also as much as possible to protect our children from the conflict that's going to be emerging between the married couple. Mm-hmm. Because we really want the child, again, to not feel like they have to choose between a parent, or we don't want them to move into black and white thinking that one is bad and the other is good, or that religion is all terrible or that religion is perfect. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's just going to set them up for further pain and suffering down the road. And we want to, as their parents, help them see that we can model for them complexity, not only in relationships, but also in the idea of spirituality itself in homes mm-hmm. with mixed faith marriages.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a big topic, a big painful topic mm-hmm. in our faith tradition.
We could do a whole series on just that.
Yes, we could. Okay, let's move to the next question. Okay, this is the last one. How to address harmful LGBTQ plus comments in youth classes? It makes my adolescents not want to go.
Yeah. This question, just like the pain that well-meaning people inadvertently cause queer kids, it just makes me sick.
It's heartbreaking.
I think if you have a queer child, it's important to talk to their leaders and make sure that the leader is on the same page in terms of shutting down any comments, making sure the child feels welcome and supported. And if they're not, then I wouldn't have my child go.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. We want, we as parents, the most important thing we can do is help our children feel safe. And the worst thing I think would be to expose our child to an environment that is actively hurting them. And therefore, yeah, I love how you talked about sort of like going in front of it and helping sort of insulate the environment to help the child feel welcome and accepted and unconditionally mm-hmm. loved. And I do want to say that in all of the interactions that I have with people in the various groups that I run and things like that, there are pockets and environments in the church setting throughout the world where kids do feel, queer kids are finding safety. Mm-hmm. Again, I think it's important to not be binary thinkers. It's not black and white. I think there are dangerous environments where things go very, very poorly. And I want to acknowledge that as well. But I think there's everything on the spectrum from very, very, you know, from safety to dangerous. And so for us as parents to just be incredibly active advocates in the well-being of our children. Something else that I kind of was thinking about as we've been kind of going back and forth on this, Julie, is that I wonder if as we advocate for our children, we could even have conversations with them and their leaders. And I guess what I'm about ready to say is something that I have wanted to say, and I plan to say if and when the situation presents itself, which is this. I appreciate that from an institutional perspective, there is a certain way of thinking and feeling about this, these beliefs about LGBTQ plus people. And I know that is the case. And also, may I propose that in our congregation, we are a safe space for queer people. So we're almost creating intentionally a pocket of, I understand that this is the way the church proper sees it, but there are people in this room right now that are actively traumatized and wounded by things that are said. And so can we please be sensitive to that reality, mm-hmm. independent of what we may formally be told from an institutional perspective? Perhaps to just create an environment where there's safety here on the ground in our congregations, even if there isn't theological safety in this issue yet, because I believe, again, it's just one of those situations where churches sometimes are the last ones to wake up to issues of social justice. And so mm-hmm. we can create pockets of safety until churches catch up and truly embody the love that Jesus Christ invites us all to embody eventually.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know why this one, like, I have a physical reaction to, I'm like feeling mama bear, like, don't you dare hurt these beloved kids. And I'm so hopeful because this younger generation, they've grown up with queer friends and family members, and they're a lot more accepting and welcoming, I think, than our generation, and more aware. And so I hope we're improving.
I know we're improving, because I agree that it is such a beautiful thing to be actually living through this evolution where people in our classes, in our generation, are having to overcome some internalized homophobia that our children, many of our children, are never going to suffer from.
Yeah.
And God bless that kind of progress that we, in, because progress moves very slowly. We know this. And yet at the same time, we're living in a really special generation where I think, especially as far as queer issues go, the pendulum has swung relatively quickly
mm-hmm.
from a lot of institutionalized homophobia, not only in our church, but elsewhere in the country, in the United States and in the world, but to where it really has swung rather rapidly. And we're seeing a lot change right before our very eyes. And so, and I think it's because of people like you and me, Julie, and our children that are on the ground saying, you can't treat other people like that.
Yeah.
And yeah. So I hope too, that this is one of those moments where if something like that were to emerge in a youth class, I would encourage my own adolescents to be a voice and to speak up and say, we don't talk about queer people like that in this classroom. I don't know that every time and every place is a time to sort of push up against the institution, yeah. but I do think there are times and places where, especially if someone is in the room and they're being actively injured, I think that that is a time and a place to stand up.
Yeah, it's bullying. Yes. I mean, you would want them to stand up for any kind of bullying.
Exactly.
And I think just really simple things that we can do as adults is wear a rainbow pin.
Yep.
Like that just signals I'm safe. Like, and you know, there are queer kids in every congregation.
100%.
They may or may not be out, or they're queer adults. And I just, you know, periodically put it on and just go, okay, I need to make sure everybody knows. Putting out a flag. Yeah. I have a little rainbow, like little yard. And I just left it up for months after Pride Month, because I'm like, you know, kids are walking by from the junior high and the elementary school. And you know that there are some who are LGBTQ.
Yeah. It's a little thing.
Yeah.
But it's a big thing. I think it's the things like that I think do matter. And the more we're able to sort of step into that role as advocate of love, because I think that's what this is it's saying, hey, we not only talk about Jesus Christ, we embody Jesus Christ. And the whole message of Jesus Christ is that of love and reconciliation. And that means everyone.
Right.
So I'm really touched by how much you're touched by this, Julie, because that is something to me at church. I feel like I can tolerate quite a high amount of other nonsense, but when someone speaks up and says something that is hostile against queer people, I almost can't tolerate it. It's too painful for me. And it's because I have so much love for that population and the people I have the privilege of working with. And when you know them, it's hard to be afraid of them because they're just like you and me.
Right. It's not us and them.
No.
It's just us.
Exactly. Yeah. There is no them, right?
Right.
Well, anything you want to add as we close up today, Julie?
I think we've covered a lot of good things. Hopefully it'll be helpful for parents listening. And I just want to thank you for taking time to just, you know, share the platform and collaborate, because it's so fun to have a like-minded fellow therapist, and you know, it just feels like, oh, I'm not alone. Yeah.
I feel the exact same way. I feel like God is a micromanager, and we do beautiful, brave work. And I think it's not a coincidence that we have found each other so that we can support not only all those beautiful people that listen to us, but so that we can be a support to each other.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, all of you who have been with us today. And we guarantee we will pick this conversation up later. We have many more questions and we have a few other ideas up our sleeve.
Yes. Stay tuned.
Things we want to talk about and share with you. And please share this podcast far and wide with people that you feel might be blessed by and benefit the goodness and love that Julie and I are trying to spread in and around the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Thanks, you all, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Take good care. Are you enjoying this podcast? Let me offer you more support and the chance to connect with other like-minded women with a Latter-day Saint background. Join my group coaching. You will be seen, heard, and you'll find a welcoming group of women. And you'll get coaching from me around topics that matter most to you. To join my group coaching, go to drjuliehanks.com/membership today and use the code podcast to get your first month free. Come try it out. Let's support each other and grow together. You are not alone. We're waiting for you. Have you ever thought, hey, I want to talk to Dr. Julie Hanks about this question? Well, now's your chance. I want to have you on my podcast. So email hello@drjuliehanks.com
with your question and the reason why you want to be on the podcast. And we may just choose you for a free coaching session.